but Hitler wanted it reduced to rubble. However, General Dietrich von Choltitz, who had been appointed military governor of Paris on 7 August, lacked the men and explosives for this task. He also feared that completing even some of the work would precipitate a general uprising that might overwhelm his outnumbered troops. He thus played a hazardous double game, destroying some token bridges over the Seine to pull the wool over Hitler's eyes, while opening up furtive contacts with the FFI through the Swedish and Swiss consulates. When it became clear that he could expect no outside reinforcements, however, he lost any remaining leverage with the resistance, and instead resolved to hold out against any uprising as best he could until regular Allied forces arrived. This they did on 25 August, but not before bitter street fighting flared up across the capital, as resistance members and Parisians rose up to avenge 4 years of humiliation, and trapped German and collaborationist forces lashed out in desperation. Around 2,000 Parisians died, together with perhaps 800 members of the FFI and the French police. Across Paris, tortured, mutilated corpses of resistance members were found, and in return Parisians attacked German soldiers with kitchen knives, and German snipers and members of the milice were summarily executed in the street. German soldiers, trapped in their burning vehicles, cried out for resistance members to shoot them and put them out of their agony, only to be left to their fate and told they could roast like pigs. In the east, the Red Army had learned caution again following Model's defeat of it before Warsaw. Had the Red Army launched a larger offensive against Model on the Vistula, it would have succeeded. Instead, the Red Army leadership was now wary of directly assaulting the Reich too soon. The Germans were also now able to anchor their defense of the Reich between East Prussia to the north and the Carpathians to the south. But the Red Army was far from done with the Germans that summer. On 20 August, the Soviets attacked Colonel General Johannes Friesner's Army Group South Ukraine in Romania. The short campaign that followed rapidly expanded from the diversionary attack it was originally intended to be into a full-scale offensive that annihilated yet another German field army. The main German force defending Romania was the reconstituted 6th Army under General of Artillery Max Frattempico. In the campaign that followed, it suffered a similar fate to its predecessor. This 6th Army's defeat, however, was much more rapid, partly because Guderian had switched reserves from Romania to East Prussia, but more fundamentally because the new 6th Army suffered all the manpower and material weaknesses now afflicting the German army on the Eastern Front. Moreover, 6th Army headquarters was too far from the operational area for it to keep a grip on the defense. Its intelligence was particularly poor. It failed to assess the strength of the Soviet offensive when it began on 20 August, then also failed to keep its subordinate corps promptly informed. Units on its southern wing were particularly in the dark about how serious the situation was. An attempt to pull out the 6th Army's easternmost units from Bessarabia failed largely because the 6th Army's headquarters had not planned a proper withdrawal. A handful of units that were able to break out to the west were rapidly encircled again. Most risibly of all, the 6th Army was relying on a panzer reserve that was fighting elsewhere. The 6th Army's subordinate corps also coordinated poorly with one another. For instance, when 29 Corps tried to link up with 4 Corps, 4 Corps made no attempt to reciprocate because it was planning its own counterattack. 29 Corps' attempt to break out at the end of August failed in the face of overwhelming Soviet strength and its own troops' utter exhaustion. The Germans also thoroughly misread the political situation in Romania. Acting, yet again, on poor intelligence, they underestimated the degree of anti-German feeling at all levels of Romanian society. They overestimated their own ability to hold Bucharest with minimum forces and protect the pro-German Antonescu regime. Worse still, they failed to anticipate the palace coup that 20-year-old King Michael initiated in September. This precipitated the fall of the Antonescu government and Romania's eventual switch to the Allies. Unlike its predecessor, this 6th Army's destruction was not total. Army headquarters and a few other units survived the debacle, and the Germans managed to establish new defenses in Transylvania. Nevertheless, the Red Army's Romanian offensive was an apt conclusion to the Germans' summer of horror in the east. It had cost them a further 20 divisions on top of their losses in Belarus. The evisceration the German army suffered in both East and West during the summer of 1944 steepened its slide towards eventual destruction. The statistics were stupefying. In August, the Wehrmacht's vehicle losses were equivalent to 6 Panzer and Panzer Grenadier divisions. German industry's ability to equip and protect the army also went into sharp decline during the summer of 1944. Up until July, production continued to rise, even though Allied bombing prevented it from rising further still, and copious equipment was being lost to other causes before it reached the battlefield. This final production increase would suffice to rebuild and sustain the German armies in East and West for a few more months, but for no longer. And from July onwards, the Allies' renewed and ever more effective bombing of German industry sent German armaments production into decline. As for manpower, the Wehrmacht reported 563,973 deaths across all services during July and August 1944, about as many as it had suffered in the whole of 1942, and 70% of what it had suffered in the whole of 1943. In the West, from the beginning of June to the end of August, the Germans lost 23,019 killed in action, 67,060 wounded, and 198,616 missing. 60,000 of the missing were registered in June and July. Clearly, such was the strain of the Normandy fighting that many German soldiers there were ready to surrender even before the calamities of August. The battles in Belarus cost the Germans even more dearly. 26,361 killed, 119,776 wounded, and 262,959 missing. A further 150,000 men were lost in Romania. The Wehrmacht intensified its efforts to recruit women for various tasks, above all desk work, even though in September the OKW issued a ruling stressing that the female soldier is not compatible with our National Socialist concept of womanhood, and that the women therefore should not carry arms under any circumstances. Overall, the army's replacement system continued to function, but it was having to feed replacements into the system too quickly for the now dwindling group of veterans to absorb and nurture them into becoming effective soldiers. A German medical officer captured by the Canadian First Army in mid-August described the Wehrmacht's youthful new recruits as being of poor physique and incapable of the heaviest work. When one compares the Wehrmacht of 1940 with today, mused Corporal Z of the 73rd Infantry Division with the 9th Army in the embattled Army Group Center, one could almost say that the soldiers could not be the same people. Before, the first question was, where is the enemy? Now it's, what are the opportunities for retreat? How do I best escape from all this? If we can't change this, then we've lost the war. The summer of 1944 was not a turning point for the German army. It was an escalating point. One reason why the Germans fought so long and hard in Normandy was that they sincerely considered it a decisive battle. In reality, they had already lost the war. Once ashore in force, the Allies not only had more men and materials, but also benefited from a narrowing gap between the quality of their troops and armor and those of the Germans. But the single most important factor in the Germans' defeat in Normandy, and the one that cancelled out the Allies' ongoing defects most decisively, was air power. Air power's most important effects were to stifle the Germans' battlefield movements and, above all, to wreck their supply and communications. Against all this, the Germans might perform admirably in defence, exploiting all the advantages of the Normandy terrain and displaying much of the old flair intrinsic to Auftragstaktik, but they could not sustain their defence for more than 2 months. Just how incapable the German army now was of maintaining a defensive effort against such odds was demonstrated by the speed with which it retreated across France following the breakout in Normandy and the invasion in the south. Such were the odds it now faced that hard-bitten adherence to the principles of National Socialist warfare was no longer enough. Thus, unlike in 1918, apart from a few spirited rearguard actions, the army made no real effort at pugnacious fighting withdrawal in 1944. In Belarus and Romania, the fact that German intelligence called wrong on the timing, location, and strength of the Soviet offensives enabled the Red Army to overwhelm the Germans all the more quickly, but it did not alter the inevitable outcome of either battle. The Red Army's success during the summer of 1944 was due not just to overwhelming force, but also to its ever more skillful prosecution of deep battle. Facing it were German formations that were largely a threadbare imitation of the force that had invaded the Soviet Union 3 years earlier. Nevertheless, in the east, as in Normandy, the fighting also demonstrated what the German army was still good at. Above all, Field Marshal Model's defensive skill and the technical and operational quality of the Germans' armoured force at least delayed the Eastern Front's total collapse. Hitler's conduct as supreme commander and as commander-in-chief of the army was arguably as misconceived during the summer of 1944 as it had been during the Stalingrad campaign. His obsession with fortified places in Belarus and his refusal to disengage from the Normandy campaign sooner precipitated unnecessarily high German losses in both east and west. It is ironic, then, that the failure of the bomb plot, a failure to which the inertia of the vast majority of the army's morally and professionally compromised leaders had contributed, reinforced Hitler's self-belief to messianic proportions. Behind the lines in France, the army's anti-partisan units still waded in less blood than many of their fellows in southern and eastern Europe, even though they were under many of the same brutalizing pressures and influences. Nor did fleeing German troops subject France to the locust-like devastation that the German scorched-earth measures inflicted during their retreat through the Soviet Union. Even at this late stage in the war, then, German soldiers were not so brutalized as to treat occupied populations with uniform viciousness. They were more vicious towards those populations whom they had been indoctrinated or instructed to regard as racially inferior, innately criminal, or innately treacherous. Chapter 23. The Army Recovers, 1944-1945. By early September 1944, the German army seemed set to collapse. "Just imagine," wrote Unteroffizier B of the 73rd Infantry Division in Poland on 2 September, "all you've heard for 4 months on the radio is, 'Forward, comrades!' Then, 'We must retreat!' Then you arrive in that situation yourself, and it's like that from day one." "What are we?" asked one officer on the Western Front. "Famished, exhausted, and drained by madmen. Poor and tired, worn out and nerve-ridden. No, no, no. It's not on any more." A garrison officer in Boulogne confided to his diary that "alcohol is the only thing which can comfort anyone in our position. I am glad my parents are not alive any more. They will not have to witness the terrible fate of our homeland." Yet the army and the Reich received a stay of execution that autumn. Although the Germans were pressured on all fronts, the pressure was less severe than it had been in the summer. Fighting on or near Germany's borders brought the army closer to its base of supply and allowed it to operate on internal lines. The Allies in east and west, by contrast, were now operating at the ends of taut supply lines, not helped, in the Western Allies' case, by the fact that the Germans were able to disrupt supply by holding several fortress French ports. The Allies also slowed their advance in east and west in order to consolidate their positions and establish forward supply bases. Meanwhile, the German army's replacement system was able to reconstitute itself somewhat, particularly because many soldiers who had been convalescing now returned to their units. And although German armaments output was in decline by the autumn of 1944, its prior feats of production had put enough equipment in the system to supply the army for a few months longer. In September 1944, when the Red Army paused on the Vistula, the Western Allies made an audacious attempt to force Germany's western defenses. By mid-September, they had liberated virtually all of France and Belgium, together with the southern Netherlands. Allied confidence was high in the wake of such rapid progress. On 15 September, Field Marshal von Rundstedt, recently reinstated as Commander-in-Chief West with Field Marshal Model focused on commanding Army Group B, issued a special order of the day stressing the peril of the moment. Every pillbox, every village must be defended until the Allies bleed to death. It is no longer a question of operations on a grand scale. The only task is to hold positions until we are annihilated. On 17 September, the Allies launched Operation Market Garden. The operation, an uncharacteristically daring idea of Montgomery's, was a lavishly resourced offensive into the northern Netherlands. Its centerpiece saw British and U.S. airborne troops land in German-held territory to try to seize several bridges over the Lower Rhine, while the British 30 Corps advanced up from the south to open a corridor linking the airborne forces with the main Allied armies. Capturing the bridges, Allied High Command believed, would put their forces over the Rhine and enable them to take the Ruhr and effectively end the war. The operation failed directly because of unexpectedly stiff resistance from Waffen-SS units refitting near the crucial bridge at Arnhem, but indirectly because the whole enterprise had been conceived and planned with hubristic haste. The Allies' failure also signified the clear, if temporary, defenders' advantage that the Germans now held. With respite in East and West, and in the wake of the failed bomb plot, the German army underwent further mental and structural changes over the following months. Although the changes increased the army's resilience, they also destroyed what remained of its professional independence. Meanwhile, army units participated in the final fits of terror and exploitation that convulsed the dwindling remains of German-occupied Europe. The bomb plot's most violent immediate effect upon the army was the purge Hitler unleashed to cleanse the officer corps of all potentially treasonous elements. The purge also targeted the non-military groupings within the German resistance. Around 5,000 individuals were arrested and hundreds of senior officers executed or imprisoned. Many of the purge's victims suffered degrading public trials at the hands of the odious judge Roland Freisler, head of the National Socialist People's Court. The proceedings were filmed, with the public humiliations heaped upon the defendants being designed to destroy their dignity in the eyes of the German public. One of their number, the retired Field Marshal Erwin von Witzleben, was deprived of a belt and braces for his trousers, and suffered Freisler's mockery as he tried to hold them up. Once the verdict of the show trials had been passed, the condemned men were taken away and hanged with piano wire to prolong their agonies. Among the purge's high-profile military victims were General Beck, General Halder, and a convalescing Field Marshal Rommel. Halder, who had had only fleeting contact with the plotters, was incarcerated in a concentration camp, but was fortunate enough to escape execution and survive the war. Rommel, Germany's foremost military hero in the eyes of its public, was famously given the option of taking poison so that the regime could avoid the ugly spectacle of a trial. He took the poison option for fear of what would happen to his family if he did not. How far Rommel actually was involved with the conspirators remains far from clear. Nevertheless, there are clues, among which are a letter of late September 1944 from Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, and a November entry in Goebbels's diary that suggests that Rommel had more contact with the conspirators than historians once thought. After Rommel's suicide, the regime circulated the cover story that the field marshal had succumbed to his injuries. The purge was not just inflicted on the army, but also by it. General Guderian, the new OKH chief of staff, was particularly instrumental. This was despite, or perhaps partly because of, the supposedly temporary nature of his new post. That Guderian had been appointed on an acting basis may well have been because Hitler also distrusted him. Despite his post-war protestations to the contrary, Guderian applied himself to the purge with the vigor of a true Nazi believer. In reality, however, he may have prosecuted it as fervently as he did for calculating reasons, not only to deflect attention from himself, but also to silence officers who might have incriminated him. Many other generals, out of conviction or fear, vocally supported the purge, and as the Nazi leadership saw it, the mass of lower-ranking officers and soldiers should also play their part in rooting out the traitors. Among other things, Goebbels deployed a special post office box for anyone, including ordinary soldiers, to post complaints or denunciations. Lieutenant General Wilhelm Burgdorf, head of the Army Personnel Office from October 1944 and a genuine Nazi fanatic, declared that the army no longer deserved the Führer's trust. Waves of arrest fueled rumors of imminent greater waves of arrests. A climate of fear enveloped the officer corps as individuals took care over every word to every colleague. That the officer corps of 1944 was so socially disparate meant that it was no longer cohesive enough to withstand the degree of subjugation that now overcame it. Or, in the words of Lieutenant General Hermann Reinecke, chief of the Wehrmacht's National Socialist Leadership Staff, the last opponents of the decisive politicization of the Wehrmacht have been eliminated. Guderian also introduced extensive new indoctrination measures. For instance, he appointed a National Socialist Leadership Officer with the Chief of the General Staff, and insisted that every staff officer also act as an NSFO. On 24 August, Guderian proclaimed that, through the treason of several individual General Staff officers, the German army, the entire Wehrmacht, yes, the whole Greater German Reich, has been led to the edge of ruin. Do not let anyone surpass you in your loyalty to the Führer. The OKH also declared, every officer is a governor, a local representative of the Führer in his jurisdiction. He is duty-bound to concern himself with everything and use every means to achieve the purpose of the battle. An officer fights and falls at his post, but he never surrenders. The most visible new measure was that the Nazi salute, or Deutsche Gruß, German greeting, as it was euphemistically called, compulsorily replaced the old military salute. The NSFO of the Second Army described the Deutsche Gruß as the visual expression of our deep belief in the Führer, his program, and our National Socialist worldview. Such measures adhered to Hitler's insistence that fanaticism, not professionalism, must be the Army's greatest guiding principle. So too did a measure Hitler himself introduced on 25 November. This order stated that any officer who no longer felt able to command could hand over to another, regardless of his rank. All that mattered was how fanatical his successor was. In January 1945, Field Marshal Keitel issued a directive not merely allowing officers to relinquish command in this way, but compelling their subordinates to remove them if they refused to step down. Many field commands were as one with these higher-level efforts. The NSFO of the Second Army, part of what remained of Army Group Center, invoked the supposed lessons of history. We have always been able to summon all our power to throw back every massed storm of Asiatic peoples from the East. He also sought to harness the troops' supposedly resurgent faith in the Führer and their detestation of the traitors by quoting from Hitler himself. Don't believe that just because a withdrawal is taking place somewhere, we are thinking in the least about a capitulation or anything similar. The idea is simply laughable. It will never come to 1918 again. So long as I live, everyone who even thinks about it will be exterminated. Germany has until now never been defeated by external enemies, but always by Germans. But the Germans who could defeat Germany are no longer here. Herein lay another key message the army transmitted to its troops. Now that the Reich had purged itself of the internal enemies that had been sabotaging its war effort, it could reapply itself to that effort with renewed vigor. More practically, the Second Army's NSFO instructed his subordinates to provide instruction to self-contained units, introduced with some words from the Führer, and concluded with a battle song of the National Socialist Movement. For the former, excerpts from Mein Kampf should be used, and for the latter, the old songs of the movement with their revolutionary fire and panache. The Second Army's NSFO was not alone in his determination. The Quartermaster's Office of the Eighth Army, under Army Group South Ukraine, would not tolerate the excuse that heavy fighting made it harder to provide the troops with effective political leadership. In the war's current stage, the Nazi leadership of the troops is a task that must be carried out seamlessly in order to maintain the troops' ability to resist. In the West, General of Infantry Gustav Adolf von Zangen, commander of the 15th Army from the end of August, believed the NSFO's main task concerned ordinary soldiers who have been separated from their unit by battle and who present themselves to another unit. Such soldiers, he declared, must be made to realize that it is in many cases necessary to put them into action with another unit straight away. The NSFO's main focal point must be on units composed of such fugitives. It is a question of turning gypsies into proper soldiers again. Wehrmacht discipline also played its part in fortifying the troops' resolve further. General von Sangen proclaimed, "Deserters and marauders who falsely claim they were separated from their unit and who allow themselves to be sent from one stationary commander to another and from one section of the front to another must be dealt with most sharply." He also wanted the troops themselves to be actively involved in exposing alleged shirkers. "The fighting soldier must be made to feel that there are swine here as everywhere else, but that they must be uncompromisingly done away with as soon as they are identified." Some low-level field units took particularly innovative measures against desertion. One prisoner taken by the U.S. 2nd Infantry Division came from a platoon that had occupied 12 foxholes, and one man stands guard at each. At night, all 12 sentries are connected by a wire tied to their left wrists. From this wire, another wire leads to a sergeant in a dugout. The wire is given a jerk when sentries change, going from one jerk to the next, thus informing the sergeant that all is well. Main purpose of the wire is to keep the sentries from deserting. If a sentry unties the wire and slips away without jerking it and arousing the sergeant, he is classified as a deserter and not as a victim of our patrols. But the most brutal martinet of all, whose Army Group North was now bottled up in Courland, was General Schirner. Ian Kershaw accurately describes Schirner as a terrifying disciplinarian, something his record towards the war's end would particularly bear out. By now, soldiers were most likely to desert because of their lack of experience or equipment, or because of their terror of Allied bombing. The measures ordered by Schirner and other commanders were therefore designed to persuade soldiers that trying to desert, or failing in one's duty in any other way, was even more dangerous than facing the enemy. "There are swine everywhere who have nothing else in mind other than advancing backwards," wrote Medical Officer Helmut P. of the 198th Infantry Division, now stationed at the southern end of the Western Front. "But thank God, these are now getting their just punishment." Yet just as the army sought ever more fervently to demonstrate its loyalty, indoctrinate its troops, and tighten its discipline, so did its status become ever more degraded. This was not entirely a direct consequence of the bomb plot. Now that much of the war was being fought on the German frontier, the army had to cooperate with the Nazi Party's civilian agencies in defending the homeland. In theory, this cooperation should have proceeded smoothly. OKH guidelines from August 1944 directed that civilian agencies such as the police, medical services, and economic bodies advise their own personnel about what to do in case of enemy attack. In turn, those personnel were to coordinate with local Wehrmacht commandants in the preparation of defenses. In reality, however, such joined-up thinking was often sorely lacking. Army officers were especially frustrated when the party's own Reich defense commissars had primary responsibility for building defenses, for many of these officials were incompetent. In Aachen, in western Germany, for instance, they threw wild parties for themselves while defensive ditches were being dug in front of the city. They also failed to evacuate Aachen's civilian population before the area became a war zone. But the failure of the bomb plot undoubtedly eroded the army's remaining power over military policy. Above all, it ushered in structural changes that further benefited the SS at the army's expense. By February 1944, Waffen-SS generals were already being appointed to high positions in several areas of military administration, and a few days before 20 July, Hitler decided to award Himmler control of 15 new Volksgrenadier, People's Grenadier, divisions. Now, in the aftermath of the plot, Hitler hailed the Volksgrenadier divisions as the vanguard of the new fanatical National Socialist People's Army that would emerge following the purging of the July traitors. In the event, the mainstay of the Volksgrenadier divisions consisted of hastily trained, patchily equipped, and poorly officered youngsters from the 1926 and 1927 intakes. Himmler had to press-gang much of their manpower, throwing in ethnic Germans, returning convalescents, Luftwaffe and Navy personnel, 16-year-old boys, and German rail workers to plug the gaps. General Balck's memoirs describe the condition of the Volksgrenadier divisions as abominable for the most part. Rundstedt was particularly scathing after the war about the decision to conscript non-Reich ethnic Germans into the divisions. "We expected a so-called Volksdeutscher soldier to give his life and blood whilst his relatives were in a concentration camp in Poland." Nevertheless, Volksgrenadier units led by experienced officers and NCOs would come to give a better account of themselves, at least until those leaders were killed, wounded, or captured. The regime would raise a great many such divisions, 49 in total, and Himmler's control over them constituted a major incursion into the military sphere. Hitler also implemented a massive SS power grab against the army's own existing remit. Now that the replacement army had proved itself a subversive cesspit in Hitler's eyes, he placed Himmler in charge of it and appointed SS men to key positions within it. Himmler was also placed in charge of the new German Home Guard, the Volkssturm. Volkssturm units were inferior even to Volksgrenadier divisions. They could include virtually any man aged between 18 and 55 who was not yet in uniform, and in time, Hitler Youth units comprising boys as young as 14 would be incorporated into them as well. Regular army soldiers viewed the Volkssturm with a mixture of puzzlement. "I don't know, this Volkssturm business is all strange to me," wrote Lance Corporal Hans B. from his barracks in Landsberg. "Derision. They often mocked the Volkssturm men as opas, or grandpas, and sympathy. Were the authorities going to stop the Red Army with them?" wrote Guy Zeyer after the war. The comparison seemed tragic and ludicrous. But Volkssturm units at least freed up regular army troops from non-combat duties. And, as their performance at the front would later show, although they were deficient militarily, they were by no means useless if deployed in the right way. In the straitened circumstances of the autumn of 1944, Hitler saw the Volkssturm, like the Volksgrenadiers, as a vital addition to German military manpower. Indeed, as many as 650,000 Volkssturm men may eventually have ended up fighting on the Eastern Front alone. Moreover, Hitler and the Nazi leadership, particularly Bormann, saw the Volkssturm as anything but an exercise in barrel scraping. In their belief that, with the traitors out of the way, they had an opportunity to renew and fanaticize the German war effort, they saw the Volkssturm as a further means of indoctrinating and mobilizing the entire German people. Hitler also believed that the existence of the Volkssturm, like that of the Volksgrenadiers, would enable the Reich to face the invading Allies with a true people's army, one whose sheer size, determination, and fanaticism would grind the Allies down. With deep defences capable of sustaining a First World War-style stalemate, German willpower and fanaticism would best Allied mechanisation and resources. In Guderian's words, the Volkssturm would show the Allies that there were 85 million National Socialists who stand behind Adolf Hitler. The fact that Hitler entrusted overall control of the Volksgrenadier divisions and the Volkssturm to Himmler highlighted his belief not only that fanaticism could stop the enemy, but also that the SS could be far more trusted than the army to harness it. Hitler restricted the army's own control over Volksgrenadier and Volkssturm formations to matters of tactical deployment. As it was, Himmler's control of the Volkssturm soon brought him into a turf war with Bormann. Now that the Reich had lost most of its occupied territory and the war was coming to Germany itself, the guileful Bormann believed that Himmler's influence had peaked and that the time was ripe for the Nazi Party to strengthen its control over the German people. But this particular turf war excluded the army. Indeed, when General Burgdorf tried to increase the army's influence over the Volkssturm, Bormann was able to frustrate his efforts. Meanwhile, the army's own long-running turf war with the Waffen-SS continued. While army officers and soldiers still valued the latter's fighting power, the rivalry between the two was ongoing. The army did gain some crumbs of comfort. When the class of 1928 was called up in October 1944, the army's share of recruits increased slightly on its share of the class of 1927, whereas that of the Waffen-SS fell slightly. That, however, was probably not because the army's position relative to the SS had strengthened, but because the position of the SS within the regime had weakened. In any case, the Waffen-SS made a further incursion into the military sphere that month, when Hitler officially designated it as part of the Wehrmacht. The final months of 1944 also saw the army and the Wehrmacht generally become more enmeshed in the SS concentration camp system. For much of the war, the army had played an important role in transferring large numbers of Eastern POWs to concentration camps in Germany as a source of expendable labor for the SS to exploit before they died. Then, in the spring of 1944, the Wehrmacht agreed to transfer large numbers of troops to work as guards in the camps. By the beginning of 1945, the troops whom the Wehrmacht had transferred comprised more than half of all male concentration camp guards. Most were reservists in their 40s or 50s. They often made for reluctant guards, and some treated the inmates with visible kindness. In the Wolfsburg-Lagberg satellite camp of the main concentration camp at Neuengamme, for instance, the new camp commandant was himself a former army captain who set up a special barrack for recuperating prisoners. In another camp, a former army colonel showed prisoners a table with food, saying, "Now dig in, my children, I think you need it." Such actions attracted the sneering derision of the SS guards. Yet despite these acts of kindness, former army personnel were still absorbed into the brutal camp system and enabled it to continue functioning. That the army was being assailed from so many directions was probably another reason why the army leadership had based itself so fulsomely before the Nazi regime during the late summer and autumn 1944. In doing so, however, it undermined those very qualities that had brought the army battlefield success. For one thing, the purge of the OKH and of senior officer levels generally created vacancies that needed filling. This meant promoting numerous officers beyond their ability. Officers in general were not just expected to subscribe to and impart Nazi ideology unquestioningly, they were now also forbidden to voice any disagreement with a superior's orders. This new veneration of the sanctity of orders further robbed the German army of the very qualities of flexibility and devolved command from which it had benefited for so long. At the same time, muzzling officers in this way was a critical reason why the German army fought on after the summer of 1944. After the purge, only officers who behaved like unquestioning loyalists were tolerated. It mattered not whether they were true fanatics, patriotic Germans trying to defend their country, or too deluded to comprehend the military situation properly. The result was the same. Officers continued to fight on, and they ordered, cajoled, and terrorized their men into doing likewise. Officers faced a hefty challenge in this respect during the final months of 1944. For even though the fronts had stabilized, and despite the widespread fury within the soldiery concerning the bomb plot, many soldiers were under no illusions as to Germany's long-term prospects. It is impossible to ascertain just how widespread defeatism was, because soldiers often dared not voice it in their letters for fear of the censors. Nevertheless, the urgency with which high command and senior field commands were seeking to re-energize their troops suggests that defeatism was firmly on the rise. So also do excerpts from several soldiers' letters. Those who did not feel defeatism themselves certainly felt it in others. "I can tell you what the most fundamental malady is," wrote Unteroffizier Herbert K. of the 7th Panzer Division, another remnant of Army Group Center, on 11 September, "and that's the soldiers' defective morale and political education. The meaning and purpose of this ordeal must be made clear again and again." Grenadier H.E. described how he, his comrades, and their officers lost themselves in alcohol. "In the bunker there is nothing else," he wrote. Even his commanding officer, whom he described as a solid man compared with the other officers, enjoyed a few when he was invited to take a glass during his rounds of the bunkers. Wachtmeister Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division, also with Army Group Center, predicted simply, "This Christmas will be the saddest of the whole war for us." The troops defending in Italy, last in the pecking order for supplies, had perhaps still greater reason for dejection. "Hopefully the war will be over soon," wrote Unteroffizier M. of the 90th Panzer Grenadier Division on 6 October. "It doesn't matter how. Everyone here has had enough. If you believe in victory, you may as well believe in fairy tales. Our revenge was supposed to come in October, but we haven't noticed it yet and don't expect to. General von Zenger-Etterlin concurred, recalling later how the German position was deteriorating and everybody realized that Germany was nearing the end. Consequently, the relative quiet in the state of war was something of a paradox. A January 1945 report by the command of the 114th Light Division described men wandering around weaponless, unwashed and poorly clothed, disregarding enemy aircraft and displaying no interest in the fight. In response to such scenes, the divisional commander declared that each of his officers must show he was a fanatical and willing purveyor of the National Socialist worldview, and the division's personnel section excoriated the troops' slapdash regard for the Deutsche Gruß. The Deutsche Gruß is an acknowledgment of National Socialism and the Führer by German officers and soldiers. The Deutsche Gruß, therefore, does not mean good morning, good evening, cheerio, but for both officers and men, Heil Hitler. Yet the fact that the battlefronts held firm indicates that enough soldiers found reason to fight on. Plenty seem to have been receptive to Nazi propaganda's efforts to amplify fears of a savage, vengeful Red Army arriving on German soil. It is now, above all, about keeping the wild hordes from the east away from the Reich, wrote Paul R., a radio operator with the 337th Infantry Division on the Eastern Front. Captain Hans-Günther E. of the 12th Panzer Division in Courland recounted the supposed content of a leaflet to Russian soldiers. "Soldiers of the Red Army, now you can claim your booty, the German women and girls. Enjoy the softness of their flesh and the lust of their sex. Then feed on the death of the fascists. Take the blonde German women, and that will break their German haughtiness." I must say, when I read this, an ice-cold shudder went down my spine. One shouldn't think any more about these words. They are awful. Uninhibited hatred and total commitment are the only answer we can give to it. Some soldiers viewed the devastation Allied bombers were wreaking upon German cities as further evidence that Germany's unconditional surrender would mean its destruction. "The Americans may yet try to get over the Rhine," wrote Hans B. to his mother at the end of November. "The enemy is too merciless for us to expect anything good from him, and we must hate him, hate like the plague." Some soldiers from Western Germany particularly feared the advance of the Western Allies. Josef L., serving in the East, wrote on 26 November, "I am heavily affected by the fact that I haven't received any news from you for 11 days. The last letter was on the 11th. Since then, the enemy is standing west of Merzig at Busendorf and Saint-Avold, north of Saarburg and south of Saargemünd, and has entered Strasbourg. Metz is as good as lost." At the Quebec Conference of September 1944, the Western Allies endorsed a plan based on proposals by U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau, Jr., to destroy Germany's capacity for future war by dismantling much of its industry and reducing its economy to a largely agricultural and pastoral state. Whilst in the event the Western Allies never implemented these plans, the Soviets would implement something along these lines in their post-war occupation of Eastern Germany. In the meantime, the Morgenthau Plan provided ample material for Nazi propaganda against the Western Allies. Wehrmacht commanders also intensified their efforts to demonize the Western Allies in terms hitherto reserved for the Soviets. Field Marshal Model, for instance, entreated the men of his Army Group B not to abandon German women and children to violation by undisciplined Negro travesties of soldiers. Here, Model was invoking memories of violations against German women that had been committed by troops from France's African colonies during the French occupation of the Ruhr. Violations which, though they had certainly taken place, had been exaggerated in their scale and gratuity by folk memory and Nazi propaganda. German soldiers felt varying degrees of credulity about the Wunderwaffen. Some still hoped that they could yet transform Germany's fortunes, and that the hope this represented was further reason for them to continue holding out. By the end of 1944, they would be stripped of such illusions. But in the late summer and early autumn, hopes were still high in places, if uneven overall. In mid-August, the Second Army's NSFO claimed, "From a reliable source, we hear about the effect of the revenge weapons in England, which at first sight really seemed to have come as a shock. In certain places, a clear panic seized the population." Rest assured, the new weapons are coming, and they will come on time, Hans Bodmer informed his mother, for National Socialism has never been late for anything, and when they are in action, the war will be decided in our favor, even though it may not end yet. Unteroffizier Werner F. of the 12th Panzer Division wrote simply, I know nothing about the new weapons, I just believe in them. We cannot lose this war. Fewer soldiers appear to have fixed on the hope that the unnatural Allied coalition would eventually split. But hopes did exist on this count also. Our defeat would simply be the end of all life and of European culture entirely, wrote Werner F. at the end of August. The English themselves must feel dread when they conceive of the chaotic conditions and the gradual Bolshevization of Italy, the Balkans, France, and Romania. What wouldn't little England do in the cause of victory against Bolshevik Europe in order to avoid being overwhelmed itself by the Red Flood? Others still resorted to blind faith. For instance, Corporal H. of the 167th Infantry Division believed that sheer stubbornness would win through, and expressed his contempt for those who did not share his faith. These weaklings, of course, don't understand the meaning of bloody-mindedness. They couldn't find it in themselves to stay seated in their anti-tank hole and let the enemy tanks come by and roll over them, like the brave warrior in the forward line has done over and over, in order to then jump out and destroy the tank in close combat. Though the battlefronts temporarily held firm around Germany itself, it was a different story further afield. The Germans could not prevent the Red Army from rapidly overrunning their Bulgarian ally in September, whereupon Bulgaria too joined the Allies. In October, the Red Army liberated the former Yugoslav capital of Belgrade. After this, the Germans were able, just, to stabilize the Balkan front. They managed to evacuate Greece between mid-October and late December, and then establish a new defensive position on the Bosnian-Macedonian border. Here they faced combined attack from the Red Army, the Bulgarian Army, and a Yugoslav partisan movement that had now transitioned into a conventional fighting force. However, the 2nd Panzer Army and Army Group E were able to hold what remained of German-occupied Yugoslavia, partly because of the terrain and partly because the forces facing it were less impressive than they looked on paper. In particular, the Yugoslav partisans experienced a painful conversion to conventional warfare and suffered heavy losses. The Germans also held out in Yugoslavia because the Red Army transferred some of its forces from that front to an offensive into Hungary. The Red Army advanced 120 kilometers, 75 miles, into Hungary in early October, yet this was another Eastern Front sector the Germans were able to hold for a while. They replaced Admiral Horthy, Hungary's vacillating dictator, with a new regime formed by the Hungarian fascist Arrow Cross movement. Army Group South, comprising the 2nd Panzer Army, the Hungarian 2nd Army, and a yet again reconstituted 6th Army, manned the Hungarian front from October 1944 to February 1945. They made a particular effort to hold Budapest, for the city was the gateway to Austria and Bavaria and a major hub of rail and river transport. Hitler was also conscious of Hungary's suddenly enhanced economic importance within the Reich's truncated empire. Among other things, it was now Germany's largest source of foreign foodstuffs, and following the loss of Romania, its oil also assumed new significance. By contrast, the Eastern Front of Germany itself barely moved during the final months of 1944. The exception was a fierce Soviet incursion into East Prussia. In October, the Red Army launched a small-scale offensive intended to destroy German formations concentrated around Insterburg and Tilsit, and to take the city of Königsberg. The Russian gives us no peace, wrote Hans Sauer to his fiancée on 10 October. Again and again he tries to break into our positions, but we always throw him back with heavy losses. On the stroke of 10 on Tuesday, the Russians fired a barrage, the like of which I hadn't seen since August last year. Now it is Saturday. The days in between were awful. You simply can't describe them with words. Even so, this was not a full-scale Red Army offensive. The Soviets called it off the following month after the German 4th Army deployed a motley handful of units against them, the fatigued 5th Panzer Division, the half-formed Hermann Göring Paratroop Panzer Corps, and the inexperienced Führer Grenadier Brigade. In a maneuver the Soviets should have anticipated, these units took the Soviet advance by surprise in its northern and southern flanks. Königsberg was still in German hands, and if anything, the progress the Red Army had made into East Prussia had only hardened German resistance. For the Red Army had given the German people an apparent foretaste of the treatment they could expect when it invaded Germany proper, when Soviet troops inflicted a grisly atrocity upon the population of Nemersdorf. 26 people were killed, 2 women raped, and the village plundered. Not only was this a savage act, it was also propaganda gold for Goebbels. He luridly exaggerated the atrocity, claiming, among other things, that civilians had been crucified, and depicted the fate of Nemersdorf as the fate awaiting all of eastern Germany if the Red Army prevailed. Indeed, many Red Army soldiers would eventually live up to some of Goebbels's bestial stereotyping, among other things in the mass rapes they dealt out to German women. The Eastern Front's northernmost sector also held. By late October 1944, Field Marshal Schörner's Army Group North comprised about 250,000 combat troops and 250 tanks and assault guns. These were distributed among the equivalent of 19 German divisions and supported by only 170 battle-ready aircraft of the 1st Air Fleet. Facing them, by Schörner's estimates, were 150 Red Army divisions, while the air power the VVS ranged against the Germans outnumbered the 1st Air Fleets by almost 28-1. But Hitler insisted that Army Group North continue to hold Courland. Partly, he believed defending it would tie down Soviet troops, disregarding the obvious fact that it was also tying down German troops. Further, like the Belarusian balcony earlier that year, Hitler saw Courland as a potential springboard for a future eastern offensive. Courland may also have played an even larger role in Hitler's plans. He appears to have been persuaded by Admiral Dönitz that Germany's one remaining hope, not just of staving off defeat, but even of winning the war, was the new generation of Type 21 U-boats the Kriegsmarine was developing. These, Dönitz claimed, needed testing in the eastern Baltic before they became fully operational, and for this reason the eastern Baltic coastal regions had to be held. This may also help explain why Hitler insisted that several other Baltic bridgeheads, as well as Courland, continue to hold out. Though German-held pockets like the Hel Peninsula and the mouth of the Vistula were less vital than Courland, they were important staging posts in supplying it. In a similar vein, Hitler also insisted on holding on to Norway. For with France lost, he considered Norway the primary base from which to unleash the new U-boats on the Allies' shipping of men and supplies to northwest Europe. With hindsight, of course, the entire enterprise looks like so much clutching at straws. But there was a rationale behind it, which suggests that Hitler's insistence on continuing the war was still being driven by something other than catastrophic nationalism or personal desperation. And Schörner, defensive expert and cruel disciplinarian that he was certainly the man to hold Courland against such odds. Defending Courland and eastern Germany was also made easier because the improvements the Red Army had undergone were not universal. A failed attack by the 1st Baltic Front against the left wing of Army Group Center at the start of October exemplified the poor performance the Red Army was still capable of, albeit much less often than before. On Germany's western frontier, the Wehrmacht similarly checked the Allies' progress. Tactically and organizationally, the Western Allies had continued to improve since Normandy, if somewhat unevenly. Their combined arms proficiency was evidently on the rise. The British role in the capture of the Channel ports in early September exemplified this process, as did that of the Canadians later that month. The Canadians also continued to innovate. For instance, General Bruce Matthews, commander of 2nd Canadian Division, cooperated with the Operational Research Section of 21st Army Group and the newly established Canadian Radar Battery to develop electronic methods of locating enemy mortars. The British and Americans, too, continued to address the limitations they had shown in Normandy. The British grew more effective at sharing and refining good practice, whether through the pamphlets Montgomery issued in late 1944 or the conferences held by formations from brigade level up. Further south, German units remained skeptical as to the fighting qualities of their American opponent. The 18th Volksgrenadier Division, for instance, compiled a report in early November which observed that he will attack only when definitely superior in materiel, tanks, artillery, and air power. Here, the 18th Volksgrenadiers were disregarding the obvious fact that such superiority was now the norm among U.S. forces. And American units were also capable of showing great daring, as General von Mellenthin observed when he witnessed them making a river assault across the Saar in early December. In the early hours of the 3rd, American infantry and engineers made a surprise crossing in assault boats, avoided detection in the fog and rain, and attacked the bridge from the rear. The garrison was overwhelmed, and the bridge was captured intact. This brilliant success was rapidly exploited. 379th U.S. Regiment crossed the Saar on the undamaged bridge, and that evening had the satisfaction of capturing the first bunkers of the Westwall. More generally, the Allies' lavish state of supply assured them of logistical conditions far superior to those of the Germans. German medical officers have been notified to exercise the strictest economy on medical supplies, asserted an intelligence report for the Canadian First Army, attributing the Germans' increasingly acute shortages to Germany's loss of important stocks of medical equipment on the various fronts and the ever-increasing number of patients in German hospitals. That said, such was the Allies' strength that their failure to break through sooner reflected ongoing weaknesses in their leadership and combat performance, and the pugnacity many German units continued to display in defense. General Bulk, who was appointed commander of Army Group G in September, informed General Jodl in a letter of 10th October that the 19th Army, a hodgepodge and poorly equipped bunch of troops such as he had never before commanded, was able to hold the line because of the poor and hesitant leadership of Americans and the French, combined with efforts of the troops who managed to put up one hell of a fight despite being grouped into ad hoc units. Bulk also ordered each of his divisions to maintain a reserve of one infantry regiment, one Sturmgeschütz battalion, one artillery battalion, and one anti-tank company. Thus would they be assured a tactical reserve that could move to a pressure point without delay. This was not always possible, but overall, Bulk later opined, the Germans held in Lorraine for as long as they did because, first, the officers and men fought with rare dedication and there was a high level of experience and expertise at all ranks. Second, we managed to maintain and preserve the freedom to conduct a mobile battle. The Germans also benefited from the presence of the Westwall between Metz and Saarlouis. Even though it was too large for the Germans to man comprehensively, most of its weapons had previously been sent to the Atlantic Wall, and its installations in general needed major work to bring them up to a properly defensible state. Where the Western Allies were most found wanting, and where the Germans took full advantage, was at the operational and strategic levels. Between 2 October and 8 November, Wehrmacht units doggedly defended the Scheldt estuary in Belgium, and with it the approaches to the vital port of Antwerp against an Allied force primarily comprising the Canadian First Army. Though the Allies captured Antwerp in early September, the Germans' defense of the estuary prevented them from fully opening up the port to shipping for a further 2 months. The Germans also exploited the defensive advantages of the Dutch waterways to slow the Allies' further advance into the Netherlands. Indeed, the advance at this northern end of the Allied line had been faltering ever since the failure of Market Garden. Eisenhower now shifted the main weight of Allied strength from Montgomery's forces in the north to Bradley's U.S. forces further south. Yet the Germans defended resolutely in this sector also. For instance, the Americans needed 2 months to capture the fortress city of Metz. General Bulk ordered the troops to dig in extensively and lay mines around each of Metz's forts. He also praised the important contribution the civilian authorities made to the city's defense. The Gauleiter offered up the local citizens as a workforce. It was incredible what they accomplished there. We reduced the front-line rations by a certain percentage and gave the excess to the fortress workers as an additional thank you. With 400 tanks per armored division and able help from specialist pioneer units, the Americans were going to breach the Westwall eventually. but they found it harder to prevail in any one place because Eisenhower's preferred broad front strategy prevented them from properly concentrating their main strength. Individual American Army-level commanders aped Eisenhower's gradual approach. Even Patton, who had roared across France in pursuit of a broken German army, attacked the German front on the Saar along its whole length, rather than concentrate his forces for a breakthrough at the Germans' weakest point. The American leadership, General Bulk remarked after the war, never understood how to exploit success and how to concentrate their incredible advantages in time and space.